Good evening. How y'all tonight? Good, Robert. How about yourself? I don't even know who to pick on first, whether it's Andrew or Bill or I don't know. I got lots of material I could go with. I'll just go on. Spread it out. So I'm good now? There we go. Okay, we're going to pick up here in chapter 6 of Judges and study about Gideon tonight. Y'all know something about Gideon, right? Yay, thank you. Everybody knows something about Gideon. So what do you know about Gideon? Because I said everybody knows something. Let's go around the room, Nancy. I was just trying to make it. Okay. Yes, ma'am. I'm going to go stand over here. Gideon, what tribe is he from? Manasseh. From the tribe of Manasseh. My daughter's laughing at me because several years ago, she asked me what tribe Gideon was from, and I said, with all the confidence I could muster, Benjamin. And she actually had to show it to me in the text that it was Manasseh. And she has never let me forget that. So she said very confidently, Manasseh. Okay. She was 13, 14, 15. Yeah. I was wrong. Anyway, y'all never heard that before. I know that. Chapter 6, verse 1. Once again, people did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's that cycle that we have been talking about throughout the book of Judges. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Okay. So once again, we start playing our game. Who's Midian? Where'd they come from? This is one of the verses in the Bible that my dad uses to show me that he knows more about the Bible than I do, because he has all of Midian's siblings memorized. I just happen to know they're found in Genesis chapter 25. I have to look them up every time. They are the sons of, or Midian is a son of, Abraham through Keturah. After Sarah dies, Abraham remarries Keturah, or marries again, rather, and remarries a woman by the name of Keturah. And through him, Genesis 25 and verse number 7 lists several children that Abraham has, and you're welcome if you want my father's cell phone number later. I'll give it to you, and you can call him, and he can show you how much he knows about the Bible by telling you their names. But they're in Genesis chapter 25, I believe, verse number 7. They are the Midianites. They settled. I don't know if we've got a map that goes out that far. No, we do not. Well, if you follow the coastline around, of course, you eventually get down to the Red Sea, right? And there are two arms of the Red Sea. And that land in between there, the two arms of the Red Sea, that's the land into which Moses fled during the wilderness, not during his exile from Egypt. And it is in that portion of the land, and then over the eastern arm of the Red Sea, which is the Gulf of Aqaba or something like that. I can't remember. Some of you oil people ought to know the eastern arm of the... Is that right?
So my map says it,
yes. Okay. Well, see, some of you oil people should know that, I would think. But they settled on down the eastern arm of the coastline of that portion of the Red Sea. And so they're southern, typically, in their origins, that they have come up into the central portions of Israel, as we read through this. Now, They're oppressed by Midian for the space of 7 years. But this does not seem to be a constant occupation. It seems to be more like raiding parties because of the verses that follow. It says, Midian overpowered Israel because the people of Israel made for themselves dens that are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. Okay? And so we have all of this region, and then the people on the east, which we've seen Edom down in this area. We've got the Moabites up in this area. You had the older kingdom of Bashan, which Moses defeated on the eastern side in there as well. All of those people gathered together, and they would raid Israel. And it says that they would encamp against them, and they would devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza or Gaza, which is over here on the western side. So they cross over, and effectively they take the produce of most of the central portion of the land. They would come up with them. Verse number 4. They would encamp against them, devour the produce as far as Gaza. They would leave no sustenance in Israel, and no sheep or ox or donkey. They would come up with their livestock and their tents, and they would come in like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be counted. Okay, what's the significance of a camel? What's that? Well, eat every okay. But in military terms, what's the modern equivalent of a camel? Of course, I said modern. Okay, y'all went from like the 4th century to like the 13th century. I wanted something with a motor, but horse, good. Cavalry, okay. Mechanized infantry, give me a tank, give me an armored personnel carrier, give me something. Something with tracks, it's quick, it's fast. Okay, these are raiding parties, okay. So they come marching up, they sweep in, they take all the produce of the land, and then leave Israel with almost nothing. And so Israel took up to living in the dens and the caves to try and find some kind of shelter to hide their possessions. Camels with the caravans would carry it all back, yes. Okay. So, of course, Israel was brought very low, which you can imagine would happen. And what'd they do? Well, our cycle again. They cried out to God. After 7 years of this, they are tired of it and begin to cry out to God. Well, again, when they cry out to God, verse number 8 says, the Lord sent a prophet. His name is not given. He's one of two people in the book of Judges that is called a prophet. Do you know the other one? Deborah is the other one. Okay. Now, I don't know if that means there were no other prophets during those times, but nevertheless, there are only two that are called prophets, and this one is unnamed. The prophet comes to the nation of Israel and says the same thing you would expect him to say as we have seen earlier in the book. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt, brought you out of the house of slavery. Now, remember, when we go back to chapters 1, 2, and 3, those introductory chapters, remember what is said, that Israel served God all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. But then what happened? There arose a generation that did not know God or the mighty works that he had done for them. So God sends them a prophet, and what's he start with? Oh, this is what I did for you. Yes, I am the God that brought you up out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. I'm the God that put you here. Now, that needs to stand in their mind in a stark contrast to all of the gods that are in the land that they're now serving. They're serving Baal and Ashtoreth. They're serving the gods of the Phoenicians and so on. They're serving the gods of the people of the land, which is just what Joshua told them to make that choice. But God is saying, I'm the one who brought you here. I brought you out of the house of slavery. In effect, then, I'm the one who led you in the conquering of all of the nations that these gods represent. And you're not listening. And so he says, I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you. I drove them out before you, and I gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice. Well, he tells them, This has happened exactly as, and I did all these things for you, and you left me, and nothing should be a surprise here. So then, we're going to turn out to try to fix this. So we're introduced now to a man by the name of course, Gideon. The angel of the Lord came and sat under the tabernacle, the tree of, in Ophrah, rather. Not Oprah, she's a TV celebrity.
No.
There are actually, I was looking on this map here and I don't see it labeled, but there are actually two places with the name of Ophrah. One of them is in the border of Benjamin. This one is probably, and I don't think it, let me go to my Gideon map and see if it's there. It would be, no, it's not. There it is, okay. In the Valley of Jezreel, which we've talked about before. Remember, here's the Jezreel Valley. There's Mount Carmel. Okay, there's Mount Tabor, and those are both going to come into play here. And then there's the Kishon River that we're running through, and this is the same area here. There again, we're just a little bit farther east in terms of the map that we've cut. There's Mount Tabor. Here is the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley that we're going to be talking about with the Battle of Gideon. So this Ophrah that we're talking about is located somewhere, we believe, up near the Jezreel Valley. Okay. It is there that there's a man named Joash. He is an Abizarite. Okay. While his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. Okay. So he's got his wheat harvest in the wine press. I have some commentators suggest that the wine press would have been smaller than what you would expect for the room in which you would beat out the wheat. So this might suggest that his harvest was small. That is what some people think. But nevertheless, he was doing it, whether it was small or not, he was doing it in a location that one would not expect him to do it, trying to hide the harvest from the Midianites who would come in and take it. Okay? The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you." Here's another example of what we talked about a few weeks ago, where there are people who believe that the phrase "the angel of the Lord" in the Old Testament might be a reference to probably the second person of the Godhead. I'm still doubtful of that conclusion, at least in every instance. But Gideon is going to say in a few verses after talking to the angel of the Lord that he has seen the Lord, he has met with the Lord face to face. So this is another passage that people appeal to try and establish that position. I don't outright disagree with it, but I'm not convinced necessarily that it's 100% right. So, but nevertheless, I'd point it out here again. He says, "The Lord is with you." And notice that's singular. Gideon, the Lord is with you. All right? I think that's going to be somewhat important here in just a second when we look at Gideon's response. He calls him a mighty man of valor. It's an interesting statement about Gideon. What is one thing you know about Gideon in terms of his the rapidity with which he responds to being called? What does he do? Tested a lot. Okay, here in just a second, we remember the second and third signs that those are the ones we think about first when we think about Gideon. It's going to be the fleece wet, the fleece dry. We can get to those in a little while. He's going to have another one before that. Not many people remember. Okay, he's going to cook some food. All right, and then after that, when we get there tonight. After the army is taken down to 300, he's told by God to go over to the camp of the Midianites. And you remember what God says to him? If you're afraid, do what? Anybody remember before we get there? Take your servant with you. So this Gideon, he is not, Ooh, he goes to the fight every time. But it takes him a minute to get there. And of course, I think it's a good character study in this regard that he is another one of those individuals that we find over in Hebrews chapter 11. Just as last week we were talking about Barak and his hesitancy to go to battle without the presence of Deborah. He wanted the presence of God with him, in, I think, in the person of Deborah. That's my understanding of what he's after. Effectively, Gideon wants the same thing. Let me know that God is with us. And so God says, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor. Then what does Gideon say in response? Notice the difference. Please, sir, if the Lord is with us. Now, I'm not sure I get everything that's going on there, but to me, that's a very interesting thing. He takes that which is very specific, and to have that light shining upon you, the angel of God just called you a mighty man of valor. That's not a loose phrase in the Bible. Okay, that's like somebody calling you a Navy SEAL or something. That when you are a mighty man of valor. David had his mighty men. He had 30 of them, I believe. All right, David had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of warriors. He had 30 of them that were the elite. Okay, when you use that phraseology, and you're a farmer's son, and Gideon, in a moment, is going to say, "I'm the least in my father's house," which I assume means of the brothers that he had, he would be the youngest. And there seems to be an indication later in the life of Gideon, after he conquers the Midianites, he's in the presence of the two Midianite kings, and he brings up an instance in which it seems the Midianite kings had killed two of his brothers. So his brothers perhaps were slain by the kings of Midian. Here he is then the least of them. And he says, "And my father's house is the least among Manasseh." And the angel of the Lord looks at him and says, "You're a mighty man of valor." I think this "you to us" thing is, let's get that spotlight off me a little bit. You know, how can I be a mighty man of valor when you're not with us? That to me is a, seems like a defense mechanism to me. I don't know. The text doesn't specify it. I'm just trying to get in my brain. If I'm sitting there and the angel of the Lord appears to me, and that's his opening line, and I look around me and I see desolation from the Midianites, I think it might take me a minute. It might take me a minute to get my head wrapped around what I'm really supposed to be doing here. And that's what Gideon does. He says, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened? Why has all of this happened? Where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian. And the Lord turned to him and said, that's an interesting phrase to me too. Where was he not turned to him before? I don't know. Is that phrase? I read the Bible. Those kind of things interest me. I don't know. Go in this might of yours. Again, what? What might?
Go in your strength
and deliver Israel. Excuse me? What might is it? Right? Do you not see I'm beating out wheat here at a wine press? What? What might? Now, I think we'll see what the angel is talking about in just a moment, because as Gideon starts to go forward, the Spirit of the Lord is going to clothe him. The angel, I think, knows something about the might that Gideon has and how it's going to be supplemented. But Gideon's not going to see that just yet. And so the angel says, go in this might of yours. Do I not send you? That's a good question.
This must have settled in the
show me state. There you go. It's the same kind of argument that Caleb makes when he's trying to quiet the people. The God has given the land into our hands. We are well able to overcome. Why? Because he's given it to us. And this is just an obvious question to God, from God. It's rhetorical. You have the might to do it. Did I not send you? If I'm sending you to do it, you either have the strength to do it or I will supply you the strength to do it. I think this verse expresses what I think is a very important concept in a lot of areas of life. Okay? God's not asking you to do something you don't have the ability to do. You either have the ability or He'll supply the ability. Okay? You having a hard time getting along with somebody? Sibling, spouse, co-worker? Y'all have heard me say this before, but the golden rule works every time it's tried. And it doesn't take two people to apply the golden rule. It takes one person. Right? It doesn't matter what the other person has done unto you. What do? What you want them to do to you. You treat them right. How many people does it take to do that? One. Under what circumstances is that nullified? None. Well, they just did X to me, and X is horrible. Fill in the blank, whatever your X is. That's horrible. That's rude. That's mean. That's insensitive. That's unkind. That's sinful. Does that nullify the golden rule? No. They just did it again. Does that nullify the golden rule? Well, no. They just did it again and again and again and again. Does that nullify the golden rule? Now, if the thing they're doing is punching me in the face, if they rear back their fist, I may duck. I'm going to stand there and take it. I may duck. I can use my brain and learn. But that doesn't mean I get to punch them first. You see, to get back to the point, who laid down that rule for life? God did. What then is His expectation? Did I not say it? If He said it, guess what you have? You have the ability to do it. You have also the obligation. I was trying to look on the positive side, though, Bill. But you're right. You have the obligation to do it. But you've got the ability to do it. I just can't go on another day. Yeah, you can. That doesn't mean it's easy. I'm not trying to make light of it. Okay? Yeah, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes it takes every ounce you got. But you can. Gideon, I'm sending you. I'm not going to send you into a helpless cause. If I'm sending you, I'm sending you because I expect you to be successful. You can do this. Well, so Gideon just jumped right up and did it, right? No, he still got some questions. Verse 15. Please, Lord, how? How can I save Israel? You know, have you ever noticed sometimes in the Bible, people question God and they're punished immediately? And then there's some other times that people question God and it's like God would never get tired of answering their questions. I think Abraham, great example. Dealing with Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham is just aghast that God would destroy the cities if there are righteous people in it. And so where does he start? 50 righteous souls, God. And at that point, Abraham. Abraham's question is, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is right? He's indignant. God, you can't do that. And he slowly steps it down. And have you noticed the more he steps it down, the more timid Abraham becomes? Where does he stop? 10. Just one more time, God, I'll ask. For 10. You ever noticed God didn't stop him? You see, I think there's something going on there in the mind of Abraham. Those cities are evil. He knows it. Lot knew it. The Bible says that Lot's righteous soul was vexed by what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. He saw the evil. He saw the evil to the point that he made sure in that very eastern way, I'm going to show hospitality to these people, even if it costs me my own well-being. He knew those visitors could not stay out in that city. And so he put himself... Okay, Lot knew. Abraham knew. Why are you mad at 50? Well, it becomes a value proposition. I don't know how many people were in Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plains, but several thousand probably. And in Abraham's mind, if you're killing 10,000 people and there's 50 righteous within it, God, you can't do it. The judge of all the earth cannot do that. I'm a little less mad at 40. I'm a little less mad at 30. I'm really hesitant to even ask God at 20. I'm pushing my luck at 10, and that's where I'll stop because I don't want to make him mad. He never asked about 5. 4, 3, 2, 1. How many people, by the way, how many visitors came to Abraham? Yeah, I kind of gave the answer away, didn't I? 3. How many visitors ended up in Sodom? 2. Where's the third one? Talking to Abraham. Okay. Got a question for you. There's 3. One's with Abraham. While Abraham is talking with the third one, the presence of God, where are the other 2? They've gone to Sodom. Why? To prepare how? What do they do when they get to the city? Lot, get your family and leave. They go to the city to get the righteous people out. How many of them? All of them. Turns out to be 4 to begin with. His wife and the 2 daughters. The sons-in-laws could have come. Turns out to be 4. 6 less than Abraham asked about. The angels are on their way to Sodom to collect the righteous 4 before Abraham ever asks. God had already made provisions to take care of the righteous. Abraham didn't understand it. He's trembling, asking God about 10. He could have asked about 4, because God had already prepared for the 4. He could have asked about 1, because guess what God is never going to do? Destroy the righteous with the wicked. Never. I'm going to flood the earth. Guess what I'm going to do? Take care of the 8. Okay? Abraham didn't get it. He didn't understand God. He got timid when he was questioning God. Now, I say all that to get you back to this point. Why is it okay to question God sometimes and not question God other times? What is Abraham doing in that? Is he accusing God of wrongdoing? No. In fact, he's concerned that God might be doing wrong. Okay? He believes in something. There's a principle that Abraham believes in. When he hears that the 50 are going to die, if there are 50, he thinks they're going to die because I'm going to destroy the city. His immediate response is, that's not right. Is that correct? Is it correct that it is wrong to kill 50 righteous people in order to bring judgment upon the wicked? Well, yeah. God's in agreement with Abraham. And so when Abraham asks the question, God's sitting there and says, that's a good question. And I'm going to teach you about that question. See, he's not actually questioning God in the sense that he's accusing God of evil.
Well, every time he asks for a certain number, God agrees
to it. God agrees to it, because God is already...
And then he started thinking about, well, maybe there's not that many.
Maybe there's not that many. That's also true. Okay? And the fact that Abraham keeps lowering the number suggests very much that he didn't think there were very many righteous people in that city. Okay? He knew Lot was righteous, and maybe he could count two. But I don't know why he stopped at 10. If he had just asked about 5, we might have gotten there. we'd have gotten close at least. Okay? Now, the point I'm trying to get here is that in the questioning of God's actions, there is not an accusation of God that God is arbitrary, that God is capricious. There is no statement of that. There is a confusion because Abraham had learned something about God. He's righteous. The judge of all the earth does that which is right. He's trying to understand the limits of what is right. And I think God is actually trying to teach Abraham something about his mercy. Okay, what is Gideon trying to figure out here? What is his question? Have I not sent you? Okay, you've sent me. What's he ask? Not yet. Look at the text. What was the question? What's the verse number? I know I wandered a long way from the text, but let's get back there. Verse 15. How shall I deliver? That's not actually a question about God, is it?
No.
No. He's questioning himself.
How he can do it.
I heard a speaker one time on parenting said, when you talk about dealing with children, sometimes a child gets mad and says, "I hate you." His philosophy about it, and I don't know if it's entirely right, but his philosophy about it was, well, that doesn't say anything about me. That says something about them. He said, the response that you give to the child is, because you've just done something they don't like and they say, "I hate you." Your response is, well, if I were in your shoes, I'd hate me too. Now, if they say, "You're stupid," well, now they've said something about you. And I think there's at least some truth in that approach to things. Okay, you hate me. I don't care. Tomorrow you'll like me. You know? I didn't know I existed on this life to make you love me. I just thought that's a pretty good thought. But listen to what he's saying. I can't do this. How am I supposed to do it? Now, when he starts asking for signs, what is he wanting? Assurance of what? Yes, put those two together. The Lord is asking him that he can do it. Put those together. That God is with him. I want assurance that I can do this because God has asked me. If you're sending me to do it, what do I need to know? Well, that I can do it. How am I going to know that I can do it? If God be for us, who can be against us? At least in his own mind, yes. Now, this could be like Moses trying to say like he can't talk. I'm not sure if Gideon may not be exaggerating a little bit. I'm the least in all of Manasseh. Well, his father at least has some influence over the people of Manasseh in a moment. But nevertheless, in his own mind, he is the least of the least. And you're asking me to do something great. He's not doubting God. The thought is, if God is with me, well, then I'll be able to do it. Same as you have with Barak. Okay? Now, you get to the New Testament, for example, and people begin to ask Jesus for a sign. And his response is, "A wicked and adulterous generation." ask for a sign. What were they doubting? Well, they weren't doubting themselves. They were doubting him. Now, they were doubting him even after having the evidence. Because when he did a sign for them, what did they say about the sign? Well, he does it by the power of the Beelzebub. He does it by the power of Satan. So these individuals are people that are never going to respond positively to whatever evidence you provide them. So much of God's response then about these kind of questions has to do with the intent and the intention of the heart of the person that is asking them. God has never been shy about providing people who do not know Him with evidence of His existence and of His power. Sometimes in ways they do not expect. My friend Eric was the first one to ever point this out to me. Go back to Exodus chapter 5 and verse 1 and 2. Who's with me, who can be against me, right? Okay. Moses ends up in front of Pharaoh. Let my people go, right? What's the question? Let's start, is it 5:1? Somebody start in 5:1 and read for a minute. Okay, that's good enough. Who is the Lord? I do not know Him. That's what he says, right? Yep, he did. And everybody else did too. And so, who is this God of whom you speak? Because there's no one stronger than I am. Okay? That's 5:2, right? Somebody read 6:5. Or 6:7, rather. You shall know that I am the Lord your God. 7:5. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. 7:17.
Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord.
8:10. Excuse me, 8:10. And you getting the point? 8:22, 9:29, 9:30, 10:2, 10:26, 11:7, 14:4, 14:18, 16:16, or 16:6 rather. That's just in the Exodus. Well, 16:12, 16:15. That's just getting us to the Red Sea. Okay, I just pulled this up real quick on my Bible app here. So I haven't sorted through this at all, but 249 times the words Lord and know are in the verses together. Okay? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of those occur before Exodus 5:2. So basically, 5 times in the book of Genesis. From the time that Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord? I don't know him." About 200 times in the rest of the Old Testament, God says, "Oh, wait a minute. I'm doing this that you may know who is the Lord." He asked a question. God answered it. Okay? God never asks people to believe something He doesn't provide the evidence for. All right? So asking God to provide evidence, never a problem. Never a problem. Unless He's already provided it to you. He's already answered the question. They kept saying, "No, Jesus is not the Son of God." And so He said, "The only sign that's going to be given you, there's one left, and you're not going to like it. Okay? See, the heart, the intention. Gideon is not rebellious here. He's doubtful. He has no evidence in his life yet that he is going to be able to accomplish the thing that God has asked him to do. He's doubtful about himself. He looks around at all of Israel and it's destroyed. It's ruined. It's been that way for 7 years. And he actually goes back to the proper source. When God says, I am with you, what does he go back to? Well, the prophet said, I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. Gideon says, back to the Lord, where are those wonderful works that our forefathers recounted to us? In his life, he doesn't have the evidence that he needs to know that I can do this. And so, yeah, man doubts himself. Absolutely. And so God says, okay, I'll give it to you. I'll give you the evidence. And so we keep reading. Oops, I'm in the wrong. Well, we get the please, how can I save him? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my father's house. That, we've referenced that already. The Lord said to him, but I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man. How many Midianites were there in the army? Anybody remember? Well, there is a number that's given later. It's 135,000, if our memory serves me right. 135,000 men. God says, you'll strike them as if they're one man. I hope he's a little man, because I try to be nice to people who are bigger than me, and that's a lot of people. Yeah, even Samson. Yeah, I hope that one man's not Samson. And he says, now if I have found favor in your eyes, show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Okay. Please do not depart from here until I come to you and bring out my present and set it before you. And he said, I will stay till you return. So Gideon went into his house and prepared a young goat, unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. Anybody have a marginal note on how much that is? You get sometimes with Bible measurements, you get different numbers. Anybody? ESV has one. If you have the ESV, you should have one. 3/5 of a bushel or 22 liters of flour. Now, some of you cooks in here, how much can you make from 22 liters of flour?
A liter is how many cups?
7. A liter is roughly a quart.
Okay, a quart is 8 cups.
8 cups. 88 cups of flour. More plus or minus. A bunch. Okay? He's not cooking a little bit. What's that? More than 5 loaves. He cooks more than 2 fishes. He cooks a goat. He cooks unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. Meat he puts in a basket. The broth he put in a pot. And he brought them to him under the terebinth and presented them. And the angel of the Lord said to him, take the meat and the unleavened cakes and put them on the rock and pour your broth over them. Now, if he's making that much food, does he actually think the angel's going to cook all of that? Eat all of that? So I'm thinking he's probably thinking there's going to be some leftovers. That's what I'm thinking. He's wrong. Pours the broth over them. Puts them on the rock, pours the broth over them. Does this sound familiar? I mean, reminiscent of something? We've got the food on the rock and we pour the broth over it. Now, what's the condition of the food? It's wet. What's the condition of the rock? Wet. Okay. See, sounds a lot like Elijah here in just a moment. And the same thing is going to happen. Fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes. The angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. That's got to be that's got to be impressive. I love how the Bible just runs right through things like that sometimes. fire shooting up out of a rock, and then the angel disappears. It's had to be impressive. It was. Look at the response. Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. Now, that was the question, right? Show me that it is you who is talking to me. Which, by the way, random thought just popped in my brain. That's always dangerous. All these people today claiming they hear the voice of God, they're also certain it's God's voice. Gideon's got an angel right in front of him, and his question is, hold on, let me make sure this is actually real, okay? He sees the sign. He goes, oh, okay, yep. Yep, guess that was real. He says a little bit more than that, though. It had a slightly bigger impact on him. He says, alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. But the Lord said to him, peace be you, do not fear, you shall not die. Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, the Lord is peace. To this day, it stands at Ophrah that belongs to the Abizarites. Okay? So, all of that takes place roughly here in the Valley of Jezreel. All right. Any questions, thoughts to that point? Because Gideon's about to go into action. We have maybe just enough time to look at a little bit of it. Unless somebody's got something. Nope. Good. Okay. All right. God comes back to Gideon. Where are we? I've lost my place. That night, the Lord said to him, verse 25, take your father's bull and the second bull 7 years old and pull down the altar of Baal that your father has. Now, there's a wrinkle for you. His father has an altar to Baal. Does that make him a priest of Baal? Don't know. Does that make him a patron of the priest of Baal? That's possible. He has two bulls. Seemingly, they are... My assumption, I guess this is an assumption, is that those two bulls that are selected were bulls that were probably going to be used in sacrifice to Baal. He has an altar to Baal, and he has an Asherah. Anybody have any other reading there? Just the Asherah? I think there's some translations that have the Asherah pole. Okay, we're in end of 25. Now, we talked about the Asherah last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago. Okay? There's the Ashtaroth, and then the Asherah. You have the grove, okay? The grove that goes with it. Okay? So you have the altar to Baal, which is the male image of their gods, and their gods were usually have one of each gender. So the Asherah is the god of the sea that we talked about. Some will have grove, some will have pole, some just the Asherah. Okay, so the altar is torn down, the Asherah is cut down. So a grove of trees or a wooden pole, probably a carved pole or something, that has the two counterpart gods both there in this place of worship. Okay, so they're both being cut down, or one's being torn down, the other is being cut down. And you build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold here. Okay, there are, you would build altars. Other Bible expressions sometimes see for them is in the high places. Okay, typically you're going to build the altar up somewhere where it can be seen, it can be worshipped, and so on. All right, so cut it down with the stones laid in due order. Take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you cut down. So we're going to take it, we're going to reuse the stones and build a proper altar to God, and then we're going to take the wood. And we're going to take the bull, which was, again, I'm making the assumption the bull was intended for sacrifice to this altar, or at this altar. And now we're going to make an offering to God there. Well, Gideon does so. But verse 27 says, he takes 10 of his servants. Now we start talking about being the least in Manasseh again. He's got at least 10 servants. So apparently Manasseh must have been a really rich tribe. No, I'm thinking he may have been exaggerating, maybe just a little bit. He took 10 men of his servants. He was a humble man. Did as the Lord told him, had told him to do. Okay? Now, some people criticize him for taking 10 of his servants. Okay, if it is a grove, meaning multiple trees dedicated to this god, how are you going to do that? See, they didn't have chainsaws. Okay? Even if it's one pole, and it's an engraved pole to the Asherah, it's probably not little. Okay, I don't know about you, but swinging an axe, I got like two swings in me and I'm done. Okay? I have found out something about my son-in-law. He likes to do things. And so if I'll start it, then lay the axe down, he'll come and pick it up. He's a sucker. Anyway. So he takes 10 men to help him. When does he go? He does it at night. Why would you do that at night? Well, it says partially he's afraid of his family. This is his daddy's stuff he's tearing down. Okay? The other part is, if he's doing it during the day, who might be there? Yeah, they might actually be using it. The worshipers might actually be there. Kind of make it a little tough to tear it down if the people are actually there. So, Gideon's not a stupid man. He takes some help and does it at night. Okay? I don't think there's anything there to be critical of. So, he does it. The men of the town rose early in the morning. Behold, the altar to Baal was broken down. The Asherah beside it was cut down. And the second bull was offered on that altar that had been built. And they said to one another, who has done this thing? Well, they start asking around. They come to figure it out. It was Gideon, the son of Joash. Then Joash, the men bring to come to Joash and say, bring out your son. He deserves to die for what he did. Now, there again is something that's amazing. These are the Israelites, the worshipers of Jehovah, the people of God. They don't care if somebody has desecrated the tabernacle. At this point, we have no indication the tabernacle is in any kind of state. But if you tear down an altar to Baal, now we're going to kill you. That is how deep they've gone. Okay? Joash says, and again, something very reminiscent of Elijah on Mount Carmel sometime later. What's Joash say? Listen. Let Baal contend for himself. If my son's done something that's worthy of death, he didn't do it to you, he did it to Baal. Let Baal do something. Kind of like Elijah. Telling the prophets of Baal, well, maybe he's out. Maybe he can't hear you. Okay? Same response. Now, this is interesting. It was Joash's place of idolatry. It was his stuff that was torn down. But the men of the city want Gideon killed for it. Well, will you contend for Baal? Verse 31, will you save him? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he's a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down. And so on that day, they called Gideon Jerubbaal, which means, let Baal contend against him. That was probably a pejorative when it started, would be my guess. They're not really happy with him. But we'll see later in the life of Gideon here, they actually begin to use it as his name. By the time you get to chapter 9, that's all he's referred to as. It takes a different connotation after Gideon has defeated all of them. Anyway, it's 8 o'clock. We will pick up here in verse 33, Lord willing, next week, right? Okay. Thank y'all. And Brett, would you say a quick prayer for us, sir?